New Thinking Aloud is a non-profit endeavor. Your contributions to the New Thinking Aloud Foundation make a meaningful difference in our ability to produce new videos.
Thinking Aloud. Conversations on the leading edge of knowledge and discovery with psychologist Jeffrey Mishlove.
Hello and welcome. I'm Emmy Vadnais, co-host with Jeffrey Mishlove. Today, we'll be discussing gifts of stress and anxiety. My guest is David Rossmarin, who is an associate professor in the Department of Psychiatry at Harvard Medical School, a program director at McLean Hospital Spirituality and Mental Health Program, and the founder of the Center for Anxiety in New York. He is author of Thriving with Anxiety, 9 Tools to Make Your Anxiety Work for You, Spirituality, Religion, and Cognitive Behavioral Therapy, A Guide for Clinicians, The Connections Paradigm, Ancient Jewish Wisdom for Modern Mental Health, From Crisis to Connection, and co-author of Handbook of Spirituality, Religion, and Mental Health, and Handbook of Torah and Mental Health. If you enjoy this program, please like, subscribe, press the bell icon, and share. David will be joining us from the Boston area. Now I'll switch over to the internet video. Welcome, David. It's a joy to have you back with me on New Thinking Aloud today.
It's so great to see you again. Thanks for having me back.
Definitely. The last time we spoke, we talked about mental health and spirituality. And today we're going to dive a little bit more deeply into your most recent book, Thriving with Anxiety. And everybody deals with stress, and many people deal with anxiety. To get us started, could you just share a little bit about what stress is, what anxiety is, and where one bumps over into the other?
Anxiety is an emotion that everybody experiences from time to time. And it's the reason why is because we're wired for it. Everybody has something called fear, the fight or flight system. And that's a good thing. That's what keeps us healthy. Neonates, babies, as soon as they're born, there's a test done right after birth to see if they have the Moro reflex, startle response. And if they don't, if we do not have a fear system, a fight or flight response, the ability for adrenaline to kick in and to mobilize us in a matter of really nanoseconds, that's not a good thing. Anxiety is based on fear. It shares the same brain circuitry. It shares the same physiology. It shares everything with the fear system, but it is a misfire of that system. So if you don't have an actual present threat in front of you, and all of a sudden you have clammy hands and a little bit of cotton mouth, and you're feeling tense and breathing's increasing and the tachycardia, heart beating and feeling flushed and hot, that's a misfire of the system. You didn't have to have that shot of adrenaline, but your body, your mind perceived a danger that wasn't really there. That's all that anxiety is. Nothing to worry about. In fact, if anything, it means that your fear system is intact. Stress is a little bit different. Stress has similar physiology, people getting their stomach in knots and their heart beating a little bit faster and the sweating, the muscle tension. But what's going on with stress is when our demands in our life, the things that we need to get done, are exceeding our resources, that which we have to accomplish things with. So for example, if you have $1,000 of bills to pay and you only have $500, you're going to have $500 of stress, right? You're 10 minutes away from an appointment that started 2 minutes ago. Well, you're going to have at least 12 minutes of stress. That's the imbalance between resources and demands. So when it comes to stress, there's really only one solution, which is increase your resources or decrease your demands, or I guess both. But they're related, but it's still a little bit different. It's not a misfire of the fear system. It's not anxiety, but it is stress, which is that imbalance. Sometimes you can have both, though, by the way. You can be really stressed out by something, and then you have anxiety on top of that. And that's when things get very uncomfortable. But across the board, these are not, you know, illnesses. These are the kinds of things that every human being has to some degree. And even at severe levels, I think we've sort of gone a little too far in mischaracterizing these as diseases as opposed to disorders. And there is a big difference.
What is the difference?
Well, I mean, a disease has to be eliminated. You know, people don't want any cancer in their system at all. It's not healthy. A disorder needs to be managed, needs to be brought down into a regular area, but it's not something that's problematic in of itself. I mean, if you had no anxiety and you had no stress, would that be a good thing? Is it even possible?
You wouldn't be able to function, right? We need some of that to go through our days.
We do need some of it. We need some of it. It's actually good to have that adversity. It helps us to grow. It helps us to thrive. It helps us to connect with others. It can help us spiritually as well. And I think often when it comes to anxiety, the goal of getting rid of it, the goal of not just reducing it, but eliminating it, actually backfires and makes it much more likely for us to experience anxiety and stress in the first place.
At the same time, you said in your book that stress and anxiety is at an all-time high, and children who are experiencing anxiety now have higher stress than people who were in psychiatric hospitals in the 1950s.
That's correct. But this is the reason why. I think in the 1950s and the 1960s, really throughout the 20th century, it was understood that people are going to have some sort of stress. People were starting their lives up after the war. They were going through challenges, real social and economic challenges of the 20th century. And it was hard. There was a lot of uncertainty. There was global uncertainty. There was the, aside from two world wars, there was the Cuban Missile Crisis. There was Vietnam. There was Korea. It was not an easy century by any means. And because of that, people expected to feel adversity.
Hmm.
As a result, when people felt distressed, there was nothing wrong with them. It was just distress that they experienced. Today, that's not the case. We perceive our anxiety and our stress as a failure. And that is what tips us over into these extremely high levels of distress, which I believe is at the core of the anxiety epidemic today.
Why do you think we perceive it as something to get rid of versus decades ago?
I think it boils down to control. Our society is very obsessed, I would say, with control, with controlling not only the external world and having predictions. You know, before we started pressing record, you were telling me how you're in Minnesota. And what's the temperature there today?
It's probably about 50 degrees.
50 degrees. And here we are in
February.
February. Right. And why does that even come up on our radar, right? Well, we'd love to be able to predict things. We'd like to be able to control things. And of course, there's advantages to that, but there's also disadvantages to having all the information at our fingertips, all of the control that we have day to day. And most of all, there's a huge disadvantage to the misperception that we can control our mood states. I don't know about you, but sometimes my emotions get the better of me.
Oh, for sure they do. Absolutely.
Of course. If we're all being honest, sometimes you're going to feel anxious, you're going to feel upset, you're going to feel distressed, and it might not make sense, but that's not a failure of the person. That's part and parcel of being human.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't think we embrace that anymore. I don't think we embrace the lack of knowledge, the uncertainty, the mystery. I think we've become very... very materialistic in our approach to emotions, to the world, and it's having some pretty insidious problematic effects on our mental health.
And you also mentioned that we have a very individualistic approach here, at least in the United States.
Yeah, that goes along with it. The more individualistic we are, then seemingly the more control we have, because I can focus on me and I have a lot more control, at least in theory, over myself than I do of others. When you take a collectivistic approach and you're focused on others and our relationships, things get a lot messier, right? Having those connections and maintaining those connections inherently hard because there's someone else who's in the picture that we can't control and we can't manage as well as we can ourselves. But that's part and parcel of being human, is to recognize the limits of our control, to recognize the limits of our knowledge, what we can even understand. And as you can see, this is how my approach of spirituality and mental health, which we've spoken about before, really relates to this thesis or this idea that you can thrive with anxiety. Just because we can't control our feelings and just because they're distressing doesn't mean those can't be a catalyst to growth. We just need to give up this false dream, false god, if you will, of being able to control it. And once we do, things turn around pretty quickly.
Well, we are in the age where mindfulness, meditation, yoga, and other methods have become very popular. What are your thoughts on those methods for assisting with stress and anxiety?
Great question. Yeah. The spiritual methods that are being used for anxiety today used to be more effective. And the reason why is because the early adopters understood that when you practice yoga, when you practice mindfulness meditation, when you try to center yourself, you are not trying to control your feelings. In fact, what you're trying to do is become more accepting of that which you cannot control. Yoga is a practice of learning to do the best you can and simultaneously fully accept that my body just will not bend in that way yet, right? There's that perfect balance between change and acceptance. And mindfulness is exactly about that. It's all about attending to the present moment, recognizing my lack of control over the future, how the past is something that is gone and I cannot intervene with anymore. That is a moment that is gone in the past. And learning to use these spiritual, deep, wonderful spiritual strategies for a place of acceptance is extremely effective because it inculcates this value and this perspective that I'm non-control all the time. However, often people misuse it today, these approaches, and they are trying to mindfulness away their feelings. They're trying to use yoga to tamp down their emotions. And that's exactly the opposite way that they're intended to be used. And I can see those as being problematic. To the extent that these facilitate acceptance, they can be very helpful. But I don't think most people are using them in that way anymore.
What are the gifts and benefits of stress and anxiety? How can they actually enhance our lives?
Great. Well, to be clear, those gifts and benefits, that thriving only starts once we have fully accepted that we will feel anxious, uncomfortably anxious at times. So if you're stuck in trying to get rid of your anxiety, those blessings, that thriving potential, it's just not on the radar. You can't see it. You have to traverse away from the coast of North America for several miles, hundreds, thousands of nautical miles until you can see the coast of the new continent. And then the opportunities become apparent. But we have to leave and be in the darkness and be over the ocean for a while with that powerlessness and perhaps with that anxiety until we can actually see the new vistas. So I'm happy to talk about that, but I can't emphasize it enough. The thriving, the opportunity for doing well with our anxiety, turning it into a strength, only occurs once we have left behind this vain hope of getting rid of it completely.
Mm-hmm. Right, because so many people are taking prescribed or non-prescribed drugs or herbs to, as you say, tamp it down or to get rid of it or to feel more calm.
Would you believe that there are 100 million filled prescriptions every year for benzodiazepines in the United States of America? That's an incredible number. Xanax, Valium, Ativan, Clonopin. These medications alone. The anti-anxiety medications. 100 million per year. It's an incredible number. We are so obsessed with getting rid of our feelings of anxiety as opposed to, why is my body feeling anxious? What is my body trying to tell me? What do I need to change? How can I enhance my relationships with myself, with others, my spiritual relationships? What is the anxiety guiding me to do if I were to actually attend to it? People run away from it before they even hear what it's trying to. Pick up the phone, talk to your anxiety first, hear what it has to say before trying to tamp it down. That's what I'm trying to convey here.
You've worked with many clients, David. What have some of your clients heard their anxieties say when they picked up the phone?
Let's talk about the stressed out clients who don't have resources to deal with the demands of their lives. They feel overwhelmed. Their muscles are aching. Their stomachs are in knots. They're having shortness of breath. And for years and years, they haven't listened to their body, which is crying out, saying, please support me more and demand less on me. And instead, what have they typically done? Taken on more projects. Taken on volunteer opportunities. Right? Hosted tons of people on the weekends. They started drinking. They wanted to drown out the thoughts and the feelings of feeling inadequate, of not having the resources that they need, feeling overwhelmed. And almost invariably, those individuals will end up in two camps. They'll either end up with a substance use or an alcohol problem, or they end up with a significant health problem, because eventually the body keeps the score and will not be able to manage. So what's the stress and the anxiety telling those people? Rebalance, recalibrate, take on less, take your vacation time from 3 years ago. Usually they have not, right? Try to figure out what you need day to day to function and get those resources in place. Be kind to yourself. Accept that you're not going to be able to accomplish as much as you want to accomplish. And that's okay. That doesn't mean you're a failure. It means that you're limited because you're human. These are the messages that stress and anxiety, just going back to the beginning of our conversation, some of the messages, I should say, are trying to teach us. And they're life lessons. They're just important, critical life lessons for all of us to learn, myself included.
There may be people listening thinking, well, David and Emmy, you don't know my life. I am working several, maybe two jobs, three jobs, or they just are gone through a divorce or some significant loss. And I know you've worked with these folks. What do you say to those folks to encourage them that there's actually potentially even a gem here for them?
Yes. So to be really clear, you know, there are periods of life where you are going to be overwhelmed with stress, and there might not be much to be able to do about it during those specific periods. If it lasts more than 3 months, we need to talk. But I'm thinking like 3 months postpartum with a newborn. Okay. That's going to be intense. You're going to feel overwhelmed. And that's not a sign of something wrong. It's just your body's going to be amped up for 90 days, maybe even a little longer, during a financial crisis. People have during job loss or after job loss, during a very, here's another one, accountants during tax season, right? In March and April, the accountants I know, they're all on edge and stressed out, but April 15th rolls around and they're a different person. People who have a major project at work, or they're in the middle of some sort of, you know, professional transition, a relationship transition, you know, all of these are normal in terms of stress. The issue is when it becomes chronic. So if someone's experiencing those for 3 months or more, when it's not going away for years, which is usually what happens, then we need to practice recalibrating, rebalancing, doing things a little bit differently, really looking at the big picture and what's going on here and why systemically. For those specific situations, obviously, you know, it's going to hurt. It's going to be hard. We have to be as kind to ourselves as possible and also accept that sometimes we just go through these periods of life. It's sort of part of being human.
In fact, you mentioned in your book that some of your most challenging cases with anxiety are people who are really well known. They can be even famous, actually financially doing quite well, and attractive people. Why is that?
Yeah, the reason is, and it's, by the way, it's uncanny. The hardest cases I've ever dealt with are the best looking, most brilliant, most well financed individuals, typically who are the children of very successful people. Uncanny. The reason to me is because of this disparity between the amount of control that they think they should have and what they really do. In reality, kids who are flying private jets since they're 16 years old, they're still human. And they still have struggles, and they can't control everything in life because they're human. It's just the way it is. You can't know everything. You can't control what people are going to say about you, what people are going to think about you, what your opportunities are. They have failures just like everyone else. Maybe not the same extent, but the issue is when a little bit of failure creeps in the context of an otherwise perfect, seemingly perfect life, it is so upsetting because I thought everything was supposed to be perfect all the time. It must be I am the failure. Mm-hmm. And that self-blame takes people down the tubes in a hot minute.
So let's get back to some of the benefits. And you mentioned that in order for us to experience those, we basically need to accept that we're not always in control. Along the lines of meditation, yoga, just planning in life, we do have a certain amount of control with some things in our life, right? So we have intentions, we set goals. So you're suggesting that at a certain point, ultimately, we don't really have control as to how those play out. Is that what you're saying?
Yeah, I don't know about you, but I have a lot less control than I think I do on a daily basis. I mean, in reality, I'm going to do my best today. You know, here I am on this interview, but I can't control the buzzing noise, which is outside my window. And I think I'm in good health, but I don't really know. And I think what you're talking about is putting your best effort forward and trying to, in the case of meditation practice, trying to remain centered and trying to do what we can. In the case of building a business, doing what you can to make sure that things are going well in terms of, you know, if it's a medical career, studying the best you can, practicing the best medicine. But I think anyone who's achieved anything, if they're being sober enough, will admit there were a lot of factors that they did not control, couldn't have known, and had to coalesce in a very unique way in order to bring them to where they are. Anxiety, I think, helps us to achieve that humility, as opposed to like, yeah, it's all me. You know, there's no anxiety in the person who thinks it was all me.
So how can anxiety enhance our lives?
When we are anxious, we're recognizing that not everything is within our control, right? If I was in control, then why am I anxious? The anxiety is our body's recognition that something is missing between the effort that I'm putting in and the result that I want to guarantee. There are no guarantees. That doesn't exist. And anxiety, I believe, is calling upon us to embrace that, to embrace that aspect of our humanity. It's such a healthier place for a CEO of a massive company to say, I'm going to do my best, but at the end of the day, I don't know what's going to happen. As opposed to like, this is what we're going to do, and for sure it's going to work. You know, that's when I get nervous. That's when I get nervous. Is when I hear people who are certain that things are going to work. There is no 100% certainty. We can have a high degree of conviction, and that's good. But that little bit of anxiety actually helps to keep us in check, to help to keep us humble, connected, focused on what we can do and what we actually can't control.
Some may say, let go and let God.
I love that phrase. It's from AA, Alcoholics Anonymous. Somehow, when it comes to alcohol and substance abuse, people have embraced spirituality. But when it comes to anxiety and depression, which are much more common, people have sort of eschewed these concepts. I like the idea of let go and let God. It sort of resonates with my personal, you know, theological and religious system. Some people don't, and I understand that. But I think we can all agree that it's important to let go.
Mm-hmm. When you were creating your Center for Anxiety in New York, you yourself were experiencing anxiety in the beginning.
Oh, yes.
Yes.
I sure was. Yeah. I mean, I was living in Boston. I had my academic career, which was starting. So that was already a lot. And I was commuting into New York. And I remember sort of the apex of it. I had one patient who I was seeing. I would come in for the whole day, spend time in my office, see this one patient, and then go home, right? A four-hour commute each way. It was only one day a week, thank God. But it was a grueling exercise. One day I get out of the train station at Penn Station. I went all the way from Boston to New York. I get out of the station and I get a text message that patient had canceled the session.
Bummer.
That was a tough day.
Yeah.
That was a very hard day. A lot of self-doubt, a lot of questioning, a lot of anxiety. And in some ways, though, it was the best day of my career because I stopped and I said, you know what? This is normal. These feelings are not a disease. You're doing something crazy. It's really, really a crazy dream. But these feelings are part and parcel of the adversity. And furthermore, you don't have a lot of control, and that's okay. That doesn't mean you won't be successful. You're going to do the best you can. And things are either going to take or they're not. Thank God it worked. And you know, today we have 7 offices, 50 clinical staff, seeing over 1,000 patients a year. It's pretty amazing. It's a pretty amazing thing. Never could have predicted that, especially not on that day.
How did you rise above or through that anxiety versus letting it take you over or under?
I had been taught and I had learned the importance of not getting rid of your anxiety, letting it be, accepting it, and letting it have its effect on you as opposed to shutting it down, trying to get rid of it. I wasn't afraid to feel anxious because I knew it wasn't going to kill me. I learned that in my training. In fact, I used it to connect with my wife. I used it to connect with my friends. I used it to connect with my colleagues, to speak to them about what I was experiencing. As opposed to pretending everything was okay and needing to get rid of these negative feelings, I used them to enhance my connection and to embrace what I couldn't control. And I didn't judge myself. I wasn't upset about the fact that I was anxious. The anxiety sucks. But what really puts us over the edge is when you get upset about the fact that you're anxious. That's the killer. And that's what everyone does today. I wasn't going to do that. I was prepared not to do that.
Right. Many people can have, as you say in your book, secondary emotions about their anxiety. Yeah. And feel a lot of shame or blame, or that somehow they're even a moral failure.
Yes. The moral failure is very common today where people, you know, something is, I wish I had the ego strength to never feel anxiety, right? That's what people tell themselves. I don't know anyone who has the ego strength to not feel anxious. I mean, adrenaline is a very powerful substance. It's woven into the fabric of your physiology. It's going to go off sometimes when you are under immense stress, pressure, when you perceive danger. There's no amount of moral strength and fortitude that's going to be able to wish away your adrenaline. I mean, it wouldn't be a good thing if you could do that. So I don't think the judgment in that case is well placed. Not at all.
Many times fear or anxiety might be showing us that there's something we need to pay attention to, or that maybe there is something to avoid. How do you suggest to people for them to be able to discern when that fear response is an accurate assessment? For example, of that maybe that isn't the job to take, or maybe that isn't the person to marry, or how to spend your weekend or something, versus that it is When is it that it's accurately speaking to somebody versus that it's just a firing that's going off and to, like in your case, continue to persevere?
Yeah, that's a good question. It's actually a great question. You know, each of those is different, the marriage one versus the job one versus other ones. Let's sort of take it step by step. I guess there are some general principles which could apply across the board, though. So maybe we'll start with that. Number one question is this a real fear? Am I picking up on something that could be or actually is dangerous? Now, I knew going into the project of starting Center for Anxiety that there was a runway, there was a backstop for a certain number of months, even longer if I needed, in order to start this practice. Now, I was expecting to have liftoff earlier on the runway, and it felt very painful, challenging to me when that didn't happen. But I didn't have a fundamental fear. And I use the word fear exactly because fear is based on a real perception of threat. It was anxiety. I'm painful. It was stress. It was definitely stress. It was very challenging to meet the demands with the resources that I had, but it wasn't to the point of actual danger to me. I had options. Relationships similarly. I talk about this in the book. I think it's in chapter 6. Relationships are messy, Emmy. You know, the best relationships you have, people are going to do stuff. It's going to tick you off. It's going to upset you. You know, I like to say, and I think this is true, the people usually who you love the most, you fight with them the most also.
Why is that?
It's because relationships are messy. When you're close to someone, then what they do matters. And they get on your nerves.
Because we care.
Because you care. And also what they're doing, you let them in. Like, you told them what you need and they weren't there for you. So you're going to be upset. Like, you let down your guard. And that's good. That's good. That's part of ironing out our differences in relationships. And what real connection is built on is, hey, what you did really hurt me. Not like, I'm done with you. Forget it. Never calling them again. Like, that canceling doesn't create connection. What does is an open and honest conversation. So when people are anxious, uncomfortable, stressed out in relationships, that doesn't mean something's wrong. It could be something's very right. But if you're picking up on, you know, narcissism, the person's vindictive, the person's doing something that's evil or cruel, they're trying to hurt you, they're abusive, you know, they're involved in substance use and they have an addiction. And there's certain things that it's like, hold on, like I'm picking up on something that I actually don't have the resources to be able to deal with long term. That's a different story. But the vicissitudes of relationships, I mean, if you're not feeling anxious in a relationship, how important can it be?
You emphasize in your book how important interdependence is with stress and anxiety. And how important it is for us to tell each other that we need each other.
This is the secret to love that I got from the folks in the emotionally focused therapy, the EFT world. It taught me a lot about the importance of vulnerability. You know, the irony of human relationships is that we are strongest when we need other people. To the extent that you are weak or vulnerable, I should say, in a relationship, that enhances the connection that you have with the other person, which gives you strength.
Yeah. Can you explain how?
Sure. I'll be very personal here. You know, my relationship with my wife, you know, 10, 15 years ago, I didn't think I needed her that much. I was wrong. But you know, my career was moving, had a gig at Harvard, I had my practice, which was growing. And I realized at a certain point that I really did need her for love, for connection, for compassion, for someone to understand me, for someone who I could be vulnerable with. Mm-hmm. And once I realized that and expressed it, things really changed and got a lot better in our connection.
Mm-hmm.
I feel more strong, ironically, today, being able to acknowledge my vulnerable nature within my relationship with her and with others. It's translated into my relationships with others as well. With friends, I'm a lot more likely to say, hey, I could really use help with this, as opposed to like, I got it, you know. I don't have it. I really do need a lot of other people on a weekly basis to be able to accomplish what I need. And that's a good thing. I love embracing that. It's made me a lot kinder and a lot more of a connected human being.
Yeah. And perhaps more content or joyful as well.
Yes, definitely more content and ironically less anxious.
Right.
Ironically less anxious. I don't need to know all the answers all the time.
Mm-hmm.
By myself.
Wasn't there a study that you put in your book about social connections and anxiety?
Sure. I mean, the best predictor of people's happiness at age 80 is the quality of your relationships at age 50.
So does that mean if you're 50 and your relationships aren't where you want them to be?
Then probably it's a good idea to work on those relationships and to embrace your vulnerability and to learn how to communicate your needs as needs. There's two ways to if you have a need from somebody else, there's two ways to communicate it. The one is, I really need this because it's a need on my part. The other is, I don't need it, but like, what's wrong with you that you're not doing that? Right? The latter usually does not beget friendships, connections, love, and it's not healthy for us ourselves. The former, I need you, means accepting, like, I'm anxious, I'm feeling uncomfortable. This is my need as a human. And that's another way that anxiety can enhance our connection with other people.
Mm-hmm.
Leaning into it.
It seems we also need to be seen in relationships.
Yes. And it's easier for other people to see us when we're not coming at them with an accusation or a demand, when we're coming at them with a need. I mean, maybe it's because I'm a psychologist, but if someone calls me up and says, hey, you know, David, I really need your help. I don't know about you, but like my ears perk up. I'm like, yes, like, what can I do? But if someone calls me up and says, like, you jerk, what did you do? How did you do that? Or what? I'm like, you know, like, please speak to my office, you know? Really, if I'm being honest, that's my approach. And I don't think it's just because I'm a psychologist. I think it's because I'm a human being.
How important is it for people to get to the core or the root of their fear, anxiety? For example, there's a lot of awareness about trauma awareness. Many people are openly discussing their past wounds and trauma. Is it necessary to heal that in order for your anxiety to transform?
It's a good question. First of all, I want to make something clear. 90% of the people who have gone through a traumatic event do not end up with post-traumatic stress disorder. Human beings are amazingly and uncannily resilient. Still, 10% do. Okay, it's a very high number, but it's not nearly what one would think. Furthermore, people can develop anxiety having not gone through trauma at all.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
Sometimes we go through anxiety, in fact, because we have not been through trauma. And when people haven't been through a traumatic experience, they expected to have more control. They expected to know what's going to happen next. And then when a tiny thing happens or a moderate thing happens, that throws them off their horse. But people who've been through a traumatic experience, sometimes they are actually habituated and understand, like, whoa, sometimes things just come out of nowhere. And that's not my fault. It wasn't because of me, and it's not my fault. And the feelings that I'm having are actually normal. So I don't know if it's necessary. I think in certain cases, though, it is. In those 10% of cases of people who've had a traumatic experience, yes. Often such people don't think about the trauma. They don't want to go there. They don't want to go there in their mind. They don't want to talk about it. They don't want to have the feelings again. They don't want to have the memories. They want to just move on and pretend everything's okay. And in those cases, for sure, we've got to schlep back into the trenches, so to speak, and remember what happened. It's not easy treatment, but it does work. It is very effective.
So from a stats perspective, more people are probably dealing with anxiety than post-traumatic stress disorder.
That's definitely the case.
So let's say that we are moving toward accepting our anxiety. What happens as we do that? And how can we do that? Because our inclination is to want to make it go away.
Yes, the inclination is very much to go away. And in fact, the minute we start moving towards our anxiety, you know what happens?
What do you mean by move toward it?
If you move towards your anxiety is going to increase. Of course, you've been avoiding it for a while. So your anxiety is going to spike. It's unpleasant. If you say today, I'm going to accept this anxiety, probably tonight you'll feel more anxious than you do right now. But give it a day or two and things come down. That high anxiety cannot sustain. It doesn't. It will come down.
Right. You mentioned in your book about the physiology of the adrenaline that kicks up the anxiety, but then actually what's happening is that there's acetylcholine, which is a neurotransmitter that's already being initiated. Is that right?
Correct. So what happens immediately, the sympathetic nervous system kicks your anxiety into gear. The minute it goes off, though, there's a parasympathetic nervous system, which tamps down your anxiety. Now, the problem is people often get anxious about the fact that they're feeling anxious, which revs up their sympathetic nervous system on a chronic basis. But if you simply let it be, that parasympathetic response physiologically will come and settle down your anxiety if you don't fight it, if you just let go. If you lean into your anxiety, you know, have you ever done acupuncture?
I have, yes.
Have you ever had it when they put in a needle? I'm not such a huge fan of acupuncture, but I have had it done for a couple of things. Have you ever had the experience where they put in a needle and it really hurts?
I have, yes.
The tendency, let's say it's in your leg, like a calf muscle. My tendency then anyway is to tense up. No, it hurts so much. And then I realize the reason it's hurting more is because I'm tensing my muscles. And that's actually physiologically increasing the tension around the needle.
Yeah.
So the solution then is to just let go and lean into it. And it's still going to be uncomfortable because the needle's still in there and it's still there. But the surrounding tissue is to lean into it and to let go, as opposed to like, I got to get rid of the needle. Because you're not going to get rid of the needle unless you take it out or ask the practitioner to take it out, which is an option. But to calm things down yourself, you need to lean into it. Anxiety is the same way. It's the exact same way.
Right. And there's also a very strong connection between anxiety and pain.
That's true. That's true. I haven't spoken about it much in the book, but what do you mean by that, Ashley? I'd like to hear your insights into that one.
Yeah, well, I am a healthcare practitioner myself. I'm a licensed occupational therapist. And in the early 2000s, I actually worked at a hospital here in Minneapolis, and it was the first integrative medicine program in the world at the time that had an inpatient program. It's now called the Penny George Institute for Health and Healing. You might know those folks. And we provided various methods such as guided meditation, imagery, massage, energy healing, music therapy, various forms of integrative health. And we found that we were able to, when people were already on the maximum dose of pain and anxiety medications, and they were a 10 or, you know, plus 10 out of 10 pain or anxiety, we would come in and provide our services, and we were able to reduce their pain and anxiety levels by at least 50%, about 80% of the time.
I'm not surprised. I can definitely see. What's similar to both is that the more you fight pain, the worse it gets. The more you fight your anxiety, the worse it gets.
That's so interesting. And I imagine there's people listening thinking, well, if I'm in pain, I'm going to take something to make my pain go away. How am I just...
I understand that. And I'm not saying we should simply never take pain medications. But And I'm not saying you should never take anxiety medications either, by the way. 50% of my patients are on anxiety. I'm not against anxiety medications. But there's a difference between taking medication for anxiety or pain to get the level down to a 4 or a 5 or a 6 out of 10 versus trying to get it to a 0 or a 1 or a 2 out of 10. Most of the time, we misuse these medications, whether it's for pain or for anxiety, to try to eliminate or to reduce it to such a small level that it's not feasible. I don't have a problem with people taking medications to get it to a middle range and then learning how to metabolize, accept, and utilize their struggles to move forward in their lives.
I would imagine you've helped your patients lower physical pain as well as emotional pain.
Could be. I haven't done too much research on that, but I'd like to think so.
I sometimes think about, you know, the Chinese finger puzzle, where if you put your fingers in and then you pull hard or try to quickly remove them, you get stuck. But if you relax, that you can easily let go.
Yeah, exactly what it is.
You have a story in your book about a woman who is obsessed, ruminating about how she either has an aneurysm or is about to have an aneurysm, and she just can't stop worrying about this, that this is going to happen to her. And it greatly impacts her ability to function, her life. Then she has, well, she works with you and you help her greatly. Then she actually has a baby who does have a neurological condition that's similar to that. And it's almost as though she maybe had a precognitive awareness about...
No. I don't think that's what we're
talking about. You don't think so?
I wouldn't say she had a precognitive awareness. I'll tell you what I think was going on there. She needed to deal with her own anxiety in advance of dealing with this very challenging life situation that she ended up facing.
Oh, I agree. Absolutely. That's very evident. But it was almost like she had that challenge herself so she could work through her anxiety, because if she had her baby like that, maybe it would have been very difficult for her to be able to...
It would have been excruciating. I don't know if she would have made it. I mean, who knows what would have happened? Had she not gone through exposure therapy, which is what we did, had she not faced her fears very, very much, at least in her mind's eye, then I think going through that challenge later in life would have been excruciating for her. I don't know what would have happened. She might have ended up in an inpatient ward. I don't know if she would have been able to make it without very significant reports.
I know we just have about a minute left here. Is there anything you would like to share about gifts of stress and anxiety and how we can move into what you refer to as a positive spiral?
Yeah, I guess I'll just, you know, wrap up to sort of connect the dots on our previous conversation and then this one, our previous one being about spirituality and mental health, and then this conversation more about thriving with anxiety, my book and my new book. I don't think I ever would have come to the conclusion that anxiety could be a good thing and something that we need to accept as humans if I didn't take a spiritual approach to mental health. Often we take a very materialistic, you know, biologically centered approach in psychiatry today. Fortunately, my department, you know, I think Harvard Medical School, were actually very holistic and understanding that psychosocial factors, even spiritual factors, as well as biological factors, interact in people's, of course, their context and their environment. All of these factors interact in the process of our emotions and our behaviors. So I'm very fortunate to be able to explore these ideas at a high level in my academic position. And I don't think there would be such a concept in my mind of a positive spiral, using anxiety in a way to connect to others, to connect more to ourselves, to become more self-accepting, and to grow spiritually without that background that I had and that I have and that I'm able to explore in my professional life. So it's definitely these two conversations that we've had very much link up together in my mind.
That's awesome. Right. And for those listening, you can listen to that interview called How Spirituality Can Enhance Mental Health. And I'll link to that in the upper right corner of your screen. David, thank you so much for meeting with me today and discussing gifts of stress and anxiety. I imagine that this conversation will help many. Thank you for being with me today.
Thanks for having me again. It was so wonderful to speak.
And for those of you listening or watching, thank you for being with us. You are the reason that we are here.
I imagine that by now, many of you already realize that, in conjunction with White Crow Books, we've just launched the new Thinking Aloud Dialogues book imprint, and our first title is Is There Life After Death?